You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. My guest today is Eileen Donahoe. Actually, Ambassador Donahoe. It doesn't say that in my notes, but we're going to add that because that's a title that's hard to get. Eileen is currently the executive director of the Global Digital Policy Incubator, which is part of FSI's new Cyber Policy Center. Although GDPI is not new, GDPI has been here for a couple of years. Her work focuses on the impact of artificial intelligence on people and society and the importance of international norms to govern its use. She was also, along with myself, one of the co-authors of a recent white paper that we did here at FSI called Securing American Elections, Prescriptions for Enhancing the Integrity and Independence of the 2020 U.S. Presidential Election and Beyond. We'll talk about that a little bit later today. Eileen, thanks for joining the podcast. Thanks for coming by.
Happy to be here.
Let's talk about GDPI for a little bit. As I just said, it has now joined our new center, the Cyber Policy Center, but it's been here at CDDRL, lots of acronyms for our listeners, by the way. That's the Center on Democracy, Development, and Rule of Law. For a couple of years, tell us, why did you have this idea? What's the origins of GDPI? What motivated you to do this?
Yeah, great question. So I would say the animating energy behind my work and GDPI's work is concern about the erosion of commitment to democratic values and human rights in the digital realm. We all know there is a global battle going on for dominance in technology.
Right.
And what we are concerned about is a corresponding geopolitical battle for governance norms and values in digitized societies. And sort of that's our space. And so our mission, we are a collaboration hub and policy incubator, that's our function. But our mission statement is we are working to inspire policy and governance innovations that reinforce democratic values and human rights in the digital realm.
That's big.
It's big.
That's big and hard.
It turns out it's, yes, you're right. It touches on many things. The way we kind of differentiate ourselves from what others are doing, I see three dimensions to our mission. One is the intellectual challenge, the conceptual framing. And I think we are all doing that from different vantage points. It's looking at that basic problem of software eating the world. Everything's been disrupted. We focus on how governance norms have been disrupted, whereas others are doing specifically cybersecurity or other dimensions.
When you say governance norms, you mean international governance norms, right?
Or domestic as well?
Well,
it's a great question. I see the international human rights framework and the post-World War II international order as reflective of our democratic values in the United States. So they should go hand in glove. There are obviously some differences, but the essence of the concepts and the values are very close. And so we have that conceptual role.
Right.
We have a normative role, which I just said what it was. Mm-hmm. And then we have a slightly different function from others. We do policy relevant research, but we are trying to bring global stakeholders from different sectors together, again, committed to this idea that multi-stakeholder processes will yield better policy ideas than if governments do it alone or private sector entities try to develop their own policies alone in a bunker.
Right.
Yeah.
And so both of those two communities need outside experts and people like you and others to interact.
Yes. They definitely
need. Even if they don't know that they need you.
Oh, they all know they need help. I mean,
okay.
I feel there's clamoring for these kinds of processes. And in fact, I think they're looking for help in the relationship between each other. So private sector entities are looking for help from civil society and academics, other stakeholders, vis-a-vis their relationship against government, because they want to ward off regulations that they don't like.
Right.
And the reason we can sometimes be aligned is because we look at some of the government policies and say, you are undermining your own values in the name of security, in the name of protecting democracy, and you're not aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, governments need help if for no other reason than they don't always understand what's going on in the platforms, and they need some translation. Intellectual mediators because they don't understand the technology and they need to come at it from the vantage point of a governing actor, and so we help in that regard.
That's interesting.
So I sort of see it as a triangle.
Right. Well, let's dig deeper into pieces of the triangle. First, with the companies, mm-hmm. sometimes referred to as the digital platform companies around here. You know, I think if we were talking 5 or 10 years ago, most certainly 10 years ago, there was a sense that they are doing work for the betterment of democracy. It was going to help democracy. Your co-partner in GDPI, Larry Diamond, if I'm not mistaken, even had a project called Liberation Technology. And we had these moments when technology seemed like it was being used for the good to promote democracy. It now feels to me, I'm not an expert, that we're in a kind of backlash against that. And there's a lot of worry that these technologies are going to be used to control people, not to liberate them. Most certainly, I just got back from China and lots of discussions about how technology helps to control people, not helps to liberate them. How do you see the balance of that? And how do you see kind of the evolution of the thinking about digital technology, the companies that dominate it, and democratic governance?
So I have to fess up, I was part of that same overly optimistic yes. group of people who...
So was I, just so you know.
I happened to be at the UN as U.S. Ambassador to the Human Rights Council right. when the first UN resolution on internet freedom was passed. And it was this wonderful foundational idea that
human... When was that?
2012.
Not that long ago. That's really interesting in and of itself.
Isn't that right? That was kind of the pinnacle of the internet freedom movement. And when right. we all assumed that tech was going to be disproportionately helping civil society right. and democratic values.
Right.
So I have to fess up to that. And that first resolution talked about applying human rights values online as offline, kind of quaint, right. now that everything is digitized and that right. distinction has collapsed.
Interesting.
And that's a big piece of what has changed. So obviously, massive techlash. I think one of the...
Techlash. I've never heard that word
before. Oh, yeah. It was one of the phrases. Oxford Dictionary held that up as one of the words of okay. 2018. Oxford English Dictionary, techlash. And I am now concerned there's been such a swing and so much focus on the tech platforms, and it's taken the focus off of the malign actors and right. put it onto the inherent features of digital technology.
Right.
Some of that is warranted, but
I'm
a little concerned about it, especially if we're having political actors move toward governance right. in ways that they don't understand. I have to also say part of what's going on, it goes back to this idea of conceptual confusion and how much disruption there's been to our governing concepts, because we don't really know how to characterize these platforms. They're sort of functioning like quasi-sovereigns,
right.
dictating the parameters of free expression right. for 2 billion people, way beyond the biggest countries in the world. And yet they don't really have democratic accountability. They have their own free speech, and they get to choose their own community values and their terms of service. And so there's tension there between there's an interplay between the rules of the platforms and the rules of the governments and the countries and the jurisdictions in which they operate. Mm-hmm. And that's creating a lot of confusion. We're trying to help develop an appropriate metaphor for what these platforms are, depending on, and they're not all the same.
That's a good point.
But some are pushing to see them as a utility. Some are, you know, it's the public square. Some say, no, they're like editors and media. Whatever metaphor you pick, the rules and responsibilities that flow from it will be different. And I don't think we have a metaphor yet.
Right.
And that's kind of the starting place.
That's the moment we're in.
Yep.
That's why we need GDPI.
Yep.
Tell me more about how you see, and I'm going to switch to the governments in a minute, but dig a little deeper because you know all these companies better than most. Do you see a shift in the way that they see their own missions? Talking about Facebook, Google, Alphabet, Twitter, Amazon, Microsoft. And I think you made a very important point. They don't all behave the same way. Their platforms are different. But what's their self kind of evaluation of their mission? And then we'll switch to the U.S. government and the Europeans.
Yep. So I definitely, they are changing. And they are looking for help. And they are particularly looking for help from stakeholders who are not part of their own companies. And uh-huh. the reason is they want other people, they want the legitimacy of other stakeholders in helping them develop the norms for their platforms. And they're even calling for government regulation in some categories because they recognize they're not that well suited to developing all of the norms for these platforms that have such gigantic effects on society.
Right.
And so simple example there is last year, and in particular November of last year, Mark Zuckerberg put out a big blog saying that he was going to develop over the course of this year, 2019, an external oversight board to help them think through the content-based decisions they make on their platforms, that look at their community guidelines, look at whether they're making mistakes in the application of them, mm-hmm. and sort of hand over some of that responsibility
to an outside group.
We've participated. I went to a big workshop in New York helping them draft that charter.
Okay.
And another parallel initiative we've done at GDPI is we convened a group of global multi-stakeholder actors to look at the concept of social media councils, which are not formed by the platforms themselves,
right.
not necessarily platform specific,
right.
but are cross-platform entities that can give guidance on how to protect core human rights values and provide some accountability for their decision making. So we're kind of working in tandem on that idea. But that's really a governance innovation. I mean,
yes.
there is no precedent for like these that. Kinds of bodies.
Right.
And so people are like rolling up their sleeves and trying to figure out how to do what's best.
Let's talk about Facebook a little bit deeper. You mentioned some think of it as utilities, others as editors. Where do you come down on that? Is it somewhere in between? And do we need external actors to help them define that?
We definitely need external actors.
They can't do it themselves.
They cannot do it themselves. I do not see them as editors. And the primary difference is they are platforms for user-generated content. That's not all they are. But to the extent they are that, that was one of the main upsides of the original internet.
Right.
Democratizing the means of distributing content.
Right.
We don't want to lose that.
Right.
And I think platform liability for user-generated content is a mistake.
Okay.
And some governments have moved there.
Right.
Obviously, Germany, various entities in the EU. And there is some conversation about changing the CDA 230 in the United States.
Tell our listeners what that is.
Communications Decency Act 230 is the provision that basically provided immunity from liability for content so that they could spread user-generated content.
So very important for the growth of the internet and
very
these
important.
Companies, right?
So what I do think they should be much more responsible for is their own algorithmic curation mm-hmm. of content.
Okay.
And they need much greater transparency and accountability for that. I have to note that the external oversight board that Facebook has put together, at least in its first iteration, is not dealing with that issue, which is the heart of the matter.
So Facebook itself has tasked them with not doing that. They want to keep that off the table for now?
Well, the way they say it is everything's on the table. This is the first iteration. We're starting with this. And there's a validity to that, too, because these are governance innovations. And just getting that piece right is hard. But most people would say the heart of the matter is the moderation and the algorithmic distribution of content, demotion, promotion.
Right.
That's what people really care about.
And we have very little insight, just to be clear, about how that works in any of these companies, for that matter, right?
That's right. And so the conversation isn't about handing over algorithms, which is proprietary information.
Right.
It's about developing ways to provide scrutability into how the algorithms work, explainability. These are your inputs. How did you get this output? And is that what you intended? And, oh, by the way, there are policies around not just content that must be taken down, which is what the oversight board is dealing with, but there are policies around what to demote and promote. And that's big.
That's big.
If you look at the Nancy Pelosi video that was slowed down.
Talk about that example. That was a really interesting case about these issues, right? So they chose not to take it was an altered video of Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi.
Yes.
They decided not to take it down, but they did kind of put it in the back using their algorithms, right?
Exactly.
Or demoted it, I think. Is that
exactly.
the right word?
They demoted it. The reason is that, in general, disinformation is not something that either governments or these platforms want to assess the validity of.
Right.
And they're going with the core free speech notion of more speech to counter bad speech when it comes to disinformation. That's a good instinct because it's very free expression protective. I personally think there's another way to think about it that would fit with their policies on moderation, which is it was manipulated. It is a form of manipulation. They are very comfortable. In fact, this was original insight. Alex Stamos, 2017, April, wrote this big paper.
Our colleague here at Stanford, our colleague at the new Cyber Policy Center.
On information operations, and basically laying out this idea that it's, without undermining free expression, it's valid to shut down manipulative behavior, manipulative mechanisms, false amplification.
Right.
And I kind of see this manipulation of video moving into that category, and I don't think you have to make a content-based distinction
to do that. Manipulation you're focusing on, not the content.
Exactly. And that is really, really helpful for protection of free expression.
Right. Let's flip it around and talk about what you see governments doing. And for our listeners, kind of compare and contrast what is so far, and this is all brand new, I want to keep emphasizing, the American government approach, legislation here versus what Europeans are doing in this domain.
On the American front, we got to say today there are a couple hearings happening that are interesting. Facebook is having a hearing on a little bit of an outlier. It's on their crypto, Libra.
Right.
And there's been a lot of resistance to that. This is not really my space, but I think the idea is they don't want Facebook gobbling up more pieces of the economy and information space than they already have, because we haven't gotten our hands around what they already own and what they've consolidated. So that's happening. Google is having a hearing on censorship through its search. And the energy behind that is Republicans and conservatives feeling like they are disproportionately squelched through search. It's a good example of where we don't know where we're at in the U.S. government on this subject. So many congressional people and senators, they've been a little bit reticent to jump in because they don't want to undermine free expression. They don't want to destroy the American internet industry.
Right.
They're starting to perk up a little bit. And I'm getting concerned that they are following the European lead in some areas where the Europeans have not been adequately protective of core democratic values and free expression. So on the one hand, GDPR, which is protection of privacy.
Privacy, right.
Which
very the good Europeans passed last year?
Yes.
Is that, okay.
Yes. And it...
Remind,
it,
the GDPR, General Protection...
Data Protection Regulation.
Regulation. Yes. Lots of acronyms in this new space.
Yes.
But that's supposed to be just about privacy, right?
It's about privacy, but in the bigger concept, because it's about data protection. And it's
right.
an interesting concept that the U.S. hadn't quite gotten to yet.
Right.
Where we don't understand the value of personal data to the same extent and with
right.
the same sophistication as Europeans. So I think that's really helpful. On the other hand, they've been so freaked out about harmful content
right.
that they have made several moves in the European context that are undermining their own commitment to free expression and
right.
democratic values.
Right.
NetzDG, the German law, is the obvious example. It does many, you know, it has really expansive categories of speech that are regulated that should not be regulated in a democracy.
Uh-huh.
It shifts liability to the platforms,
right.
which inspires, you know, because of big fines for failure to do it, it motivates over-censorship.
Right.
And it kind of shifts what we would normally consider democratic responsibility for assessing criminality.
Right.
To the private sector. And so I find that really problematic.
Right.
In the UK, there's a new white paper out that's getting a lot of attention that is trying to make a move into this idea of duty of care for harmful content that's not illegal. The dangerous concept here is a government is asking platforms to restrict content and be liable, I mean, a tort basis for content that is perceived to be harmful in cases where the government itself couldn't have done that. Again, it gets into these democratic accountability.
That's a very slippery slope, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why, if I'm not mistaken, I remember when we wrote our report together, the final chapter was your chapter, and you kept your group, your team, because you had a fantastic team, by the way, kept saying it's not just about American elections. This is an international problem, and we need international norms to govern this space.
First off, that white paper was a great exercise to bring us all together, and it really showcased the strength of Stanford and bringing a comprehensive diagnostic look at what happened in 2016, a wide array of concrete recommendations. And also, I think it served to generate some political will around something that very little has happened to solve in the United States. Our job was to show that the U.S. case is a very big data point.
But just one data point.
One, and that the United States' responsibility should be to lead globally on this issue, the threat to democracy writ large.
Right.
And then we were also trying to underscore the relevance of international norms to building political will and international alliances to combat this and international cooperation. So we tried to remind people it's not only about free expression and privacy. It's also about the right of sovereign individuals to participate in government and select their government leaders.
Right.
And that is the right that's being undermined. The threat to democratic integrity is a national security threat. It's a cybersecurity threat. But it's also a threat to democratic values and international human rights norms, which we believe should be seen as a really important linchpin in international peace and security.
Right. Great mission you have at GDPR. Big, hard, complex things.
Yes.
But I think about other technologies and other moments where international norms have developed. We are in the very early stages here. And as a part-time consumer, part-time participant, it's kind of exciting to be part at the creation, right?
I have to say one thing. Our mission at GDPI is trying to advocate for use of existing universal human rights norms.
Right.
Our argument is we have the principles. What we need to do is articulate how to apply them in this radically changed environment.
Exactly.
We do not think it is a good moment geopolitically to start with a completely blank piece of paper and throw our values and principles out the door. And so we are definitely advocating for that. And that it's a really challenging thing. Hold on, but move ahead and rearticulate that vision.
Well, I'm so glad you're doing it here at Stanford. Thanks, Eileen, for joining us today on World Class.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening in the world and why.